Hello, this is Hugo Lane, returning as host of New Books in East European Studies after a long absence. I'm happy to be back and looking forward to speaking with Tom Junes about his recent book, Student Politics in Communist Poland.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fine, and it's a pleasure to have you on the line to talk about your book. You know, we always, at New Books in History, we usually ask people just how they got involved in studying Eastern Europe, and you can talk, if you tell us a little bit about that, as well as your specific interests in Poland.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the program. How did I become a historian of Poland? And it's, in a way, it's a long and complicated story, and I'll try to be very brief. It might be important to mention that for me personally, Poland has never been really far away because I have a link with the region, and although I was born in Belgium, I'm of Polish descent, and I was raised knowing and using the Polish language with relatives in Poland. Though as such, that did not really lead me to becoming a historian of Poland, especially because I grew up, spent most of my childhood beyond Europe, and I only came back to Europe at the end of the 80s, and that's where I remember my first visits to Poland. And of course, this was a period that Poland for a while was quite in the news, because at the end of the 80s, of course, we had the collapse of communism, we had the Round Table, and I was going into high school in Belgium, and then in the early 90s, basically Poland, Eastern Europe sort of disappeared off the radar. What was more sort of decisive towards that path was that by the time I was finishing high school and getting ready to go to university, for a variety of reasons, as a student, I had become politicized and sort of on the left side of the spectrum, and I was dwelling in this leftist student milieu where we very often had discussions about history of communism and socialism, the history of the Soviet Union. And that kindled a kind of interest in me to want to learn Russian and learn more about Russian and Soviet history. And in part that led me then to decide actually to enroll at university in the Eastern European Studies program, which was sort of my first step towards becoming a historian of Poland. But in the first years, my main interest lay with Russian and Soviet history, and it was only at the time when I had to start thinking about doing my research for a master's thesis. In the summer break of that year, I was backpacking through Central Europe. And when I arrived in Warsaw on the first day, I passed the university campus in the center in Krakowskie Przedmieście. And I was very impressed by the campus. I mean, it just captivated me. And I thought, well, I mean, it would actually be kind of cool to return here, come back here and do research here for my master's. And this prompted me to change my focus from Soviet history to what ultimately became a topic on studying Solidarność and the imposition of martial law. Now, for myself, turned out that topic was kind of a hot topic and widely debated among historians and in the press in the 90s, because there was also a big parliamentary inquiry into the reasons for the imposition of martial law and so on. And I thought it would be like kind of a challenge. And I set myself one condition: okay, I'll do this, but I'll go to Poland, and I really want to meet the main perpetrator, the main protagonist, who was, of course, General Jaruzelski. To cut a long story short, I succeeded in doing that. I did my research, and I found it fascinating, and I really got hooked through that research on the history of communist Poland. And then a few years later, I decided to go to grad school and do a PhD in history. And it really didn't take a lot of time or imagination to figure out that the research I wanted to do would be on the history of communist Poland again. And it was around this time also that the idea emerged to study the student movement under communist rule.
Now, yes, and that's an interesting topic in itself, and because, of course, people always talk about 68, but we tend to think about the workers' movement more, and then the cooperation with the workers' movement was something like CORE. So what was the reason for focusing on students and student movements?
Well, initially, I mean, sort of how the idea came to be crystallized to venture on that path was the result of some discussions I had with my then supervisor. And I did my PhD in Leuven, which was in Belgium quite a big setting for student unrest in the 60s, and 68 there really changed the university in the sense that it changed from being a Francophone university to a Flemish university. And my advisor actually was one of those 68ers. And apart from being the chair in Polish history, he was also specialized in student movements. And in these discussions, we sort of came to the conclusion that, well, you know, there's not much done on students actually in Eastern Europe, in Poland, and if this would not be a good idea for me to pursue. And I have to say, well, this was a topic I could personally really relate to, and I became very passionate about. Now, of course, it's always important to kind of ask that question of like, okay, why does this matter, and should we actually care about student movements? Because as you said, I mean, the main narrative in Poland is about workers, church, intelligentsia, and apart from 68, students don't really figure in that major narrative. But let me make just a few points to kind of argue that case. And it's, well, first of all, there's this broader historical context of the region. There are fairly deep traditions of student activism in Central Eastern Europe, and in Poland particularly. Students played an important role in various movements for national liberation, national independence, spearheaded revolutionary movements since the early 19th century. Now, this role tends to be overlooked because typical characteristic of student movements is that they're transitory and they don't leave a lot of records behind for historical research. And on the other hand, if one makes too much of a focus on student movements, there's always a risk that, let's say, the broader movement or broader events are taken less seriously. Some scholars have called this like the phenomenon of children's crusades, actually. And then there's also this element that in the classical Marxist view, students and intellectuals were not really seen as independent social actors. This is something that, of course, changes in the scholarship of the 1960s as well. But it's clear, though, that student movements manifested themselves most clearly when there was some kind of an alliance with a broader social movement. Students would then rather act as a vanguard or as an activist recruiting pool. But it's a fact that students alone don't create or force revolutionary change. On the other hand, universities were always centers of revolutionary activity, and students, they were carriers of pretty progressive modern ideas. I've already mentioned nationalism, but there's liberty, socialism, equality of opportunity. These were ideas that were sometimes ahead of their time and would only come to the fore later on a broader societal scale. In part also because student activists could become more significant political players in later life. So ultimately this reason of why to study student politics was because one can see students as constituting a sort of social and political barometer of sorts. Student politics can be an indicator of social and political change. And this was exactly one of the points that so captivated me about the history of communist Poland, that this was a period with a lot of social and political change. There's another reason why I also, and this sort of came later, why I realized that it was quite interesting to focus on, is that student activists, they became part of the country's future elites. And after 89 in Poland, many former student activists, they became prominent figures in political, cultural, academic spheres, in the media. It's also interesting to note that in Eastern Europe, many of the so-called oligarchs, they also came from within the ranks of the former communist youth organizations. So in effect, I mean, student movement, student politics under communism is also important and matters because it kind of it advances a further understanding of certain post-89 developments.
And certainly I can say from my own personal experience living in the Warsaw University dorms that all the students I knew were interested in politics and involved in it. And there was, I still have a Tygodnik Mazowsze that I picked up there to right there, hanging out in a stairwell. And I was happy to get it through the customs on the way out. I think when I read the book, I mean, this is one of the things that struck me is how much more there is. I mean, I did remember one of my own Polish friends, the father had been a student in Poznań in 56. And of course, the students do play a role there as well. As you say, you know, reading the book, it does come out with the importance of the building of elites. Now, when moving on then, your book, you know, it covers, you know, roughly 40 years, a bit more than 40 years. And, you know, when you, and a lot of it works on sort of generations, but your generations are a lot shorter than most people's.
Mm-hmm.
When we generally, you know, when historians talk about generations, it's, you know, of course, it's a rather vague term, but people tend to talk about 15 or 30 years, you know, they're thinking along those lines. And, you know, you're talking really about almost, you know, five or six at the most. Could you talk about that? And is that something specific to students, or is it Eastern Europe or the Polish People's Republic?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and you're absolutely right to point that out. And historians generally, we have a problem when we use this category of generations. There's much more tools available when we look at sociology, but still, I mean, it remains this kind of vague and slippery concept. Ultimately, talking about generations, it makes most sense to talk about them in both the biological and social context in which generations are formed based on socialization experiences and particularly certain decisive important events in which people participated or witnessed that really defined their consciousness. But the big difference in why my book has so many generations in a period of 45 years is exactly because I'm talking about students. The problem of generations is actually inherently linked to student politics, and especially when you're studying it over a longer period, because we're dealing with a social group that is actually continuously changing. The student body every year is getting depleted with certain age cohorts. I mean, students are graduating. At the same time, you have new age cohorts that are entering the student body. Now, if we take, in an ideal world, let's say that the duration of studies is 5 years, then we can assume that if that would be the case for everybody, that we would have a totally complete new social group every 5 years. And if we take that into account, of course, it's not the ideal world. So there are students who stay longer at university for a variety of reasons. There are people who do PhDs and stay longer affiliated to the student body. But in any case, when we talk about especially political generations and the fact that the more political and generational events that occur can spawn and define more frequent generations, then this actually gets magnified within the student body. Because let's say when we have a major student revolt like there took place in 68, the youngest students who would have witnessed and participated in that revolt would have probably already left the student body like 5 years later. At that point, you get the potential of a completely new generation arising. And in my research, this is exactly what I traced, that you get this succession, quite quick succession of different experiences and different like decisive generational events, which was very typical, of course, for the speed of social and political change in communist Poland. Now, if you would take somebody who would write a history of the cultural intelligentsia or of writers in communist Poland, well, this person would come up with a completely different length and succession of generations. So it very much is defined by the fact that it's linked to student politics.
Okay, and why don't we start going through those generations? I think, you know, you start chronologically, and, you know, I think one of the biggest differences is between the first generation, which you say or suggest has a lot to do with pre-war conceptions, and then the second generation, which you say is the one that were that came the most stalwart supporters of the PR regime. And what happened with that, and why? And why was there never another cohort of students that was as beholden to the regime as those that came to the university in the years of Stalinism?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a very complex question, but I mean, very much to the point, even in part, that it contributes to, I think, our understanding also why communism failed. Ultimately, and as you already said, that sort of first generation of students right after the war, it was very much transitional. I mean, there were still people remembering the pre-war era, during the war, continuity being then, and then they leave the university while the communists are actually starting to build socialism. So this is accompanied, of course, by enormous social and economic change. I mean, they enact a six-year plan. They start industrializing. They need to create a working class because Poland was still very much an agricultural country. They needed also to create a new intelligentsia, a new educated class that could actually help build socialism and would kind of represent this utopia of the new socialist men and women. And this is exactly what happens in this period. And let's also not forget that this is a relatively short period. I mean, this is a period that starts more or less the Stalinist period in academia in 1950 and ends towards the middle of the decade with de-Stalinization. And you have three elements basically that are of importance to sort of understand your more general question. And first is demographics. Second is the regime's economic and political policies. And third is, of course, the general attitudes within the student milieu and the student body. What happens in around 1950, so late 40s, 1950, the regime realizes that, well, we need experts, we need to create this new intelligentsia that will build socialism. So they immediately embark on a more enhanced higher education program. They initiate some reforms as well. But what they do due to ideology, they also try to change the class background of the student body. So they try to bring in also a lot of students from worker and peasant backgrounds. There was a third category at the time, which was called the working intelligentsia, which was sort of this loophole through which your more traditional students would still get into university. And for these young people from worker and peasant backgrounds, and it's important to note again the demographics, within a period of 5 years, the student body basically doubles from around 50,000 to 100,000, which is enormous. At no point in the rest of the history of communist rule in Poland do they have this kind of relative increase in such a short period of time. And for these young people who are part of that, part of those cohorts from working sources, they're getting opportunities that they would have never been able to dream of before the war. I mean, they can go to college, they can get an education, they can make a career, they can get an apartment, they can live an urban life. And they become eventually the new elite in communist Poland, and many of the top positions in every sphere of the political and the economical institutions at the end of the 80s are still very much occupied by members of this generation, exactly because these members, they become dependent upon the regime for their careers, for their livelihoods. Now, politically, this generation and this period becomes somewhat of a problem that will never get resolved throughout the period of communist rule. The overall majority, and there's a huge ideological drive about the Stalinist period, and the overall majority of these students, they turn out to be outward conformists, and but they're not completely like believers in the utopia, but still, like I said before, this dependence really defines them, so they're very loyal to the regime. The problem arises that a minority, still a significant number of people, but a minority, actually are true believers in this utopia, in this building of a new world. But it is exactly these people who rebel during de-Stalinization and rebel against Stalinism, rebel against the regime, cause trouble for the regime. And this becomes dangerous because the regime is actually confronted with a kind of paradox. On the one hand, they want loyalty. They want conformism. They don't want actual political passivity, but on the other hand, they don't want too much politicization. And there's this tension that arises that the regime never manages to resolve, because like once a group of students gets politicized in the 60s, they ultimately instigate the revolt of 68. So this pattern keeps on repeating. At the same time, this should be seen, of course, against the backdrop that after de-Stalinization, the regime sort of loses its totalitarian utopian drive. At one point, they're no longer talking about building socialism, building communism. It's all just really existing socialism. What you see is what you get. The system is stabilized. But at the same time, you have a demographic evolution, one in which the student body still grows. So ultimately, it doubles again by the end of the 1960s to just over 200,000 students. And then by the end of the 70s, it's already bigger than 300,000 students. But this is also at a time when actually the general demographic evolution evolves to the point that at the end of the 1970s, one in two Poles is younger than 30. So you have a huge group of young Poles out there, of which students are only a small part, but everybody's more or less dealing with the same problems, and they're posing the same challenges for the regime, because the regime, of course, has to provide housing, has to provide jobs. There is less of a chance for social upward mobility, because as I said before, this Stalinist generation is already there. So, and every generation coming behind is actually getting less opportunities to climb and progress in life, which creates some resentment. And this resentment, for instance, I mean, in the 1970s, you have Gierek coming in with opening Poland up to the West with this rhetoric of this policy is trying to build a second Poland that is more prosperous. But at the same time, this raises expectations, but the regime gets into economic trouble. And this is one of the main causes also, of course, of the outbreak of revolt in 1980-81. Now, the third point, and this is, of course, the curious part, is that we actually have very good sources documenting attitudes of students, because a team of sociologists in Warsaw from the late 50s up till the late 80s was doing sociological surveys among the student community. And one of the key questions until the early 80s was about what their feelings was of how the world was evolving. And it turns out that the majority of students, still even in the late 70s, thought that the world more or less was evolving to some kind of socialism. This did not mean necessarily socialism of the Soviet kind, but still some kind of socialism. That only disappears in the 1980s. That's when then young people suddenly stop believing in any kind of socialism. But this is, in essence, the core of why there's such a contradiction, because that generation that is coming of age, that gets socialized, that studies under Stalinism, they take up the best spots. They actually get the best deal, relatively speaking. They're dependent on the regime, so they're loyal to it. Everything really, their whole life is formed by that experience. Whereas every generation that comes afterwards just gets confronted with less opportunities, and for that becomes more resentful and less loyal to the regime. And this is one of the reasons as well one could see why communism and the communist regime got into trouble, because every new young generation believed less and less in the feasibility and in the positive aspects of the regime, and they didn't see that this was a construct, a reality that was really corresponding to their own ambitions and aspirations.
You know, I'm thinking about this, and one of the people who's very interesting, you talk a lot about Poprostu and the, you know, the student newspaper. And what came to mind there as we were talking about this is the curious case of Jesse Orban.
Mm-hmm.
A man who really did seem to fit that earlier Stalinist view. He wanted very much to be, and he tried four times to get into the, the Communist Party. Yet, you know, he's crucial to this critical side of things as well. Where do you put someone like him?
Well, I put him exactly with that cohort of, let's say, true believers, because especially this role of Poprostu, I mean, this is really where it comes out of these, I mean, these radicals, these young people who want to build this new world and see that not everything is as it should be, which only gets worse once, of course, in Moscow, Khrushchev delivers his secret speech, which was then later also disseminated in Polish translation. It was quite widely available. And these young people, they start rebelling exactly. I mean, this is sort of the irony that the then Stalinist regime, they actually created a cohort of young people that would become sort of their nemesis, so to speak, because another member of that cohort of true believers, I mean, Karol Mozalewski, and he put it very nicely. I mean, he said that, well, you know, when we heard what Khrushchev said about Stalin, we couldn't believe that this was...
This is in 1956. This is a secret speech, right?
Yes, this was a secret speech. So after reading that, and like I said, it was available. I mean, there were like 30,000 copies available in Polish translation. So it was known within weeks on a very wide scale what was said and what was criticized about the Stalinist regime. And Mozalewski, he would then say, well, look, I mean, this could not just be the result of one man and his character. I mean, this was probably something wrong with the system. And as they taught us, I mean, if the system is wrong, you got to overthrow it. And how do you overthrow it? You do it through a revolution. And who makes the revolution? Well, it's the working class. But they don't do it alone, but in alliance with students and intelligentsia. So we basically proceeded exactly according to the blueprint and rebelled exactly how the Stalinist regime had taught us of what it means to be a revolutionary. So, and this is, into a large part, the story of Orban as well. I mean, he, of course, stays loyal to the regime in later years, because he becomes the speaker for Jaruzelski in the 80s and so on. But actually, he's one of those very interesting types who in the mid-50s come out of this Stalinist camp and exactly really spearhead the struggle against Stalinism and for de-Stalinization.
So, we won't talk too much about the Mogilevsky and Quiron letter, but the aftershock of that, which is 68, one of the things that really, I think, struck me as important in your book is how you debunk the standard view. You know, we got it when we watched a bit of Man of Marble, but definitely Man of Iron, where you have this notion that the students went out in 68, the workers weren't interested, and then in 1970, especially in Gdansk, the students, out of spite, do not join the workers' protests. And could you just talk a little bit about what evidence you found that shows this the problems with that narrative?
Well, this was something that I came across while doing the research, and actually very much not intentionally. And it turns out that this was one of the big discoveries that I did. And as you already mentioned, right, it's a pretty potent myth, and it's really being dramatized by Vida in his movie. Now, to a certain extent, I mean, there are two elements that, of course, worked to that misrepresentation. One was, of course, the regime propaganda at the time, where the regime organized counter rallies at factories against the students in 68. And then, of course, kept on using the same kind of tactics in 1970. The regime also very much tried to isolate and silence what was going on in the places where worker unrest had broken out. I mean, the regime was always interested in a divide and rule game. I mean, it's also very typical for communist regimes throughout history to use a tactic, and that when students would rebel, that they would use workers or some kind of worker militia to kind of counter the students in their protests. But what happened was that I ran across two articles about 68 that already pointed to the fact that our knowledge about these events was wrong. And in part, this is also being sustained by, let's say, the most famous student activists or most known student activists in 68. They, of course, weren't there in 70 because why? They were on trial and were in prison. So they couldn't be there. And many of these became the later known dissidents who then also participated in Solidarność. So this was another element that perpetuated that myth. But then later, historians after 89, and I ran across these articles that were already pointing to the fact that, well, something's not right with the story. Because if we look at the number of arrests made in 68... it's interesting to see, actually, that the largest group arrested were working-class youth. These were not students. And then I went further into the archives and checked all what I could find on these arrests. And exactly, this is the one conclusion one could come to, is that workers were the biggest group on the streets arrested. Not necessarily the biggest group protesting at all, but I mean, there's a simple explanation as well. I mean, young workers have the energy, they want to fight the riot police, they hear that these students who are the same age are getting beaten up by the riot police, so they come and join in. They have perhaps more of an enthusiasm to get into a violent brawl, and they get arrested. But still, the numbers are quite significant, and this kind of thesis that the workers were aloof makes no sense at all when you look at these documents. The only reason, of course, why this image of 68 sort of got projected is that afterwards, the main, or let's say the most known repression that was a consequence of the revolt was against mainly groups of students. And then coming to this conclusion, I was already like thinking along generational lines. Well, rather the common denominator of the revolt seemed to be youth. Now, given the closeness of the two revolts, I decided to check if I could find any traces on the 1970s and on the 1970 revolt. And this was, of course, a bit more tedious because, I mean, the places which had seen the biggest worker protests, these were not really big or even at all academic centers. So by default, you wouldn't have a lot of students there. Then there was another element, which is also quite important in the overall narrative when it comes to workers and students. These worker revolts tended to break out at times when students were not there. So either during exams or during university holidays, university breaks. So you wouldn't have a lot of students around as a group to actually join those revolts. But then I came across some memoirs, and even one of them was by Lech Wałęsa, who actually makes this allusion that, I mean, workers actually joined the students in 68. And I'm thinking, well, I mean, if they joined in 68, is it really true that students would have stayed aloof in 1970? Because that wouldn't have made sense. And again, I ran across some testimony already to, it was about Gdańsk, and there the author in question actually argued that students were present, but they weren't present as a group because it was right before the Christmas holidays and a lot of students had left. But they did go out on the street and support the workers, but they were just not that visible. And then this was an interesting case, but probably not enough to try and trace the student participation in it. So I came up with the idea that, let's check the student towns. And I went to the archive in Kraków, and I just came across documents from the security apparatus and from the police records from the militia that apparently, I mean, first of all, there had been a huge operation to try and neutralize the student milieu before they introduced the price hikes that led to the worker revolts. But then secondly, despite that actually hundreds of students came out on the streets in defense of the workers once the news had leaked out that workers had been shot. And then in the arrest records, it turns out that most of these people who had come out on the streets were people who had been seen or arrested in the March 68 revolt in Kraków. And I sort of had my smoking gun where I realized that, well, you know, again, you get a revolt where, though the milieus are more spread out, it's the same young people or the same age group that is coming out on the street, revolting, using the same slogans. And in a sense, we should probably redefine our understanding of 68 and 70 as part of a broader sort of moment of generational revolt against the communist regime at the end of the 60s.
So more like the West than we think
I'd of. Say, I'd say even more, it was actually more a case of solidarity because in the West, there was more of a difference between students and workers. I mean, the student milieu was very much differentiated, still very much seen as elitist. I mean, it's really during the revolts that students realize that they want to go and see the workers. There's an important thing that one also needs to take into account about communism in Poland is that young workers and students, they were socialized in using the same political language. They had less trouble crossing these kind of class boundaries in understanding each other. So the divisions by default were a bit less visible between the student milieu and the working class milieu. So, but yeah, ultimately, it was, we can sort of say, if we go beyond this very narrow symbol of 68, that we were basically dealing with a similar generational revolt, East and West.
And that sort of paves the way, of course, for what then unfolds in the 80s. In the 80s, you know, I have a personal interest in, because mm-hmm. I have experience, you know, I live... I studied at the Catholic University of Lublin in the summer of 85 and then spent the rest of the year at Warsaw University in 85, 86. You know, having experience, I didn't, you know, since I didn't experience Poland in 80, 81, I was still struck by what struck me as remarkably free, you know, what
the society was, particularly in the student milieu. If I was supposed to be witnessing a life in a totalitarian state, and I mean, of course, I'm sure, and I know that my student friends didn't feel that way. One had a button. I mean, which this is a wonderful bit of irony. She had a button that said, "Stop the Stalinization of our universities," and that she could wear that button. She got one of her instructors took her down, saying, "You don't know what real Stalinism is." But I mean, but nonetheless, she was wearing it, and yet, you know, it's a really interesting, you know, sign of what Poland was like. But how do you know? That's my experience when you're looking at it from the archives, and so you know, I had this two-pronged question. How did normalization shape the student movement in the first half of the 1980s? At the same time, how did the student movement shape political life and normalization?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is one of the things that struck me as well, but then from a different perspective, like being the historian, going into the archives. And I should also say that probably the largest group of people I managed, of the former activists I managed to interview, were actually from the 1980s. And by the way, that what you said about that badge, and you don't know what, I mean, there you already have a generational difference. I mean, somebody who experienced Stalinism telling somebody who only had an imagination of what Stalinism was. And this was quite, I think, telling for those students and those youths who lived through the 1980s, because you talked about totalitarian state, but we should also add that, I mean, Poland in the 80s was basically a state ruled by a military junta. I mean, the army was in control, the security apparatus and police forces were quite prominent. I mean, there was a certain risk of repression. I mean, martial law was imposed, thousands of activists were interned. And I mean, curfew was imposed, and then it was, martial law was lifted gradually, and then you had the normalization period. What was very interesting to learn was that despite martial law, that in the academic milieu, there was a new law that was enacted. And this law was nearly completely based on a law that was actually negotiated between the opposition and the student opposition and the regime before martial law was imposed. And it went very far in granting academic freedom and autonomy to universities. So this was an immediate like contradiction, because of course when they imposed martial law, they banned and disbanded all student organizations. But on the other hand, this new law actually made provisions for self-government councils. So students managed to, for instance, organize themselves in a very democratic manner at their universities and actually continue their activism despite martial law, and very often with the support of the professoriate. So universities, to a certain extent, became these islands of freedom under martial law and normalization. Outside of the universities, of course, youth would radicalize. And what you see is a very stark rise in violent demonstrations and brawls and street fights with riot police emerging from the early 80s, and this becomes a sort of cult-like ritual throughout the 1980s. The period you referred to, that you were in Poland, this was actually also an interesting period, because this is when it starts turning around, because the regime realizes that it actually has given perhaps too much freedom to students and tries to change that higher education law, make it more repressive. And, oh, irony, this is a time when most students who had experienced Solidarność and martial law had left the university, and there were already new cohorts of students, a new generation of students coming up, and they had been radicalized in high school. They'd been very much anti-communist, and this kind of badge of what you mentioned, Stop possible Stalinization. I mean, this was indicative for a lot of members of that generation. I mean, they saw the martial law authorities as this was Stalinism incarnated for them. At the same time, they didn't realize that under Stalinism, you just couldn't go out on the street and have street fights with riot police because there was a different kind of repression, right? But this kind of fuels them in their radicalism, and towards the end of the decade, it's really young people and students who are fueling these sort of new grassroots opposition movements that emerge. And this creates a very new dynamic and ultimately would set the stage for, you know, the return of Solidarność and the strikes and the roundtable negotiations that lead to the fall of communism. And for a large part of that generation, there were also other phenomena because they become completely, they start rejecting politics as such.
You're saying the students.
Students. There's this phenomenon called like internal immigration, so sort of return to the private life. But at the same time, you see this this rise of youth counterculture, and especially the Polish rock scene, the alternative rock scene was pretty strong. And the regime there as well enacts some, in a way, liberal policies despite martial law and allows for the organization of pretty big concerts, the most famous one being the one in Jarocin, where thousands of youths come together and, you know, can let their energy loose to this rebellious punk rock and reggae and heavy metal, which ultimately becomes kind of the base of a movement of a new rebellion, of a general criticism of the reality they see around them. So as the decade goes on, young people and students at universities who start organizing themselves again start rekindle, I mean, the public opposition against the regime. So in this sense, I would say that on the one hand, the normalization by actually, I want, if one could put it this way, by not being repressive enough, allows for students to still be active. And then at the point when they actually want to turn on the screws, these young people rebel and they really set the stage for what is to come at the end of the decade. And that is the ultimate collapse and implosion of the regime.
And that, you know, you're talking about the strikes of the young workers. And I gather what you're saying, the students were playing a role in, you know, we're talking about 1988, this, you know, the which pushes the buttons that sort of wakes up the older generation to say, we've got to do something. But I was struck, you know, you say that the students played a role in that, but you also speak of this moment of the round table as being a moment of betrayal for the student movement. That's, you know, an interesting phenomenon. What happened?
Well, it is indeed interesting. And, I mean, as historians, we can always benefit from hindsight. And I would even say that there was a certain logic to what took place. Students, as I just said before, and young people, also high school students and so on, they became quite active in these new contesting oppositional grassroots movements. And then in early 88, so this process goes on, and students actually, meanwhile, revive the old band, Independent Students Association, that had been founded during the Solidarność period. And that was sort of a direct linkage with that period, and it was a strong statement. And what happens is that in March 88, you have the 20th anniversary of the student revolt in 68. And all these oppositional students decide to do something. And they come out in force, and their demonstrations are quite successful. Their rallies are quite successful. Some of them get pretty harshly met by the riot police and so on. But what they see is that their movement is growing, that their movement is strong. These students as well, they've been busy in the underground press, printing their underground journals and so on through the 80s. So they had gained a certain expertise in political organization, political agitation. This was also a period, so late 87, 88, the regime tries to enact some economic reforms because they see that, well, you know, the crisis just isn't going, we need to reform more. And then they decide, instead of just going ahead with it, to have a referendum, which they then also lose, but they try to go ahead with the reforms anyway, which also means, well, the typical set of price hikes and so on. And the workers react. You get worker strikes in May. And these are workers that actually, again, I mean, they don't have any firsthand memory of the Solidarność period at the beginning of the decade. These workers are the same age who lead the strikes, who initiate the strikes. They're of the same age as the students. In fact, the old Solidarność leadership was against the strikes initially. This is an important aspect. But who comes to support these young workers? It's the students. They go to the factories. They start helping the workers organize. They share their expertise with printing, with agitation, and so on. Plus, they initiate solidarity strikes at the universities. And through that, while the strikes were a lot less numerous than at the beginning of the decade when Solidarność was founded, they actually managed to give the strikes quite some visibility. So it's a psychological blow to the regime because from the archival documents that I consulted from right after the strikes, you have discussions in the Politburo where they are saying the biggest problem we have right now is youth. We've lost them. We've lost. We need to get out of this mess. Now, to make it worse, a few months later in August, when of course there was a summer break, workers go on strike again. And this time, I mean, students actually also go to the factories despite it being vacation because this generation of students is just so politicized and they go and they stand with the workers. And again, that strike movement then catches the attention of the regime and they decide like, well, the only way to get out of this is to start negotiating with the opposition. But they don't want to negotiate, of course, with these young rebels. So they negotiate with the people they know from the beginning of the decade who are more moderate at the time. And actually, the old Solidarność leadership strikes a deal they will end the strikes in return for negotiations. And this is ultimately the process that then leads to the round table. Now, when it comes to the betrayal, it's quite an interesting story because, and we can illustrate it best by a quote from Lech Wałęsa himself, who, when the round table starts, and also being conscious at the time that, well, students played a role, and these radical students, they weren't happy at all that the opposition was going to negotiate with the communists because they didn't want to negotiate. They wanted to overthrow them, radical and young as they were. That's what they were. I mean, the most radicalized part of the student movement was so anti-communist that they would not dream of striking a deal with the communists. They did not believe in that kind of strategy. But Wałęsa even says that any agreement, just like a good table, should stand on at least three legs. The first was Solidarność, the second was rural Solidarność, and the third was the independent students organization. Now, these were three organizations from the Solidarność period that had been disbanded, suspended, delegalized. So the point of them was that these three organizations had to be legalized. That was the condition of the opposition going into the negotiations. What happened was that, Solidarność gets legalized, but ultimately the opposition agrees to not legalize the student movement, the student organization. This is mainly why the round table is seen by the radicals as a betrayal. And at the same time, the students, they start rebelling against the negotiations, and there are a lot of violent demonstrations happening in some of the most radical academic centers. And this even turns the student movement actually into the kind of black sheep that is being used by the regime vis-a-vis the opposition. And it's also interesting to note that the only subtable at the round table negotiating process where there was no agreement reached was the one dealing with youth. So ultimately, when the round table concluded and provisions were made for the first semi-free elections, this was done without having consolidated any achievement for the student movement. And well, the student activists basically saw this as a betrayal of their interests by the opposition, who was then supposedly negotiating in their name. And they held one last national strike. But in the end, most of them anyway went to vote because they saw that they were engaged in the electoral campaign and of Solidarność. And well, they realized that this was an opportunity to at least show their defiance by voting for the opposition, because, of course, nobody knew what would happen the day after, and that Solidarność won with such a landslide, and that this would lead to the end of communism. But the fact remains that the students very much got alienated by the elder opposition during the negotiating process because they were basically cut loose.
That is an interesting story. Carrying on with that, because this touches again on that, it was absolutely no surprise to read names like Kuron and Michnikin in this book, nor was it entirely a surprise to read Kwasniewski, given that he was a leader of the student organization, the communist student organization. Yet he's an exception. So many of the people that you come up in the later phase of your book, as far as student activists, we would link to the conservatives, including Komorowski, for example, comes up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you explain that? What happened? Is this just part of that general trend of the older generations not being able to deal with the need to open way for the new, or is there something else going on?
Well, there's something else going on there. Actually, a lot of different things are going on at the time, and one of the crucial things is that 68 happens. 68, not only in Poland, but also beyond Poland, in Czechoslovakia. This is a year where students who are protesting and invoking the Constitution, still using what one would perceive as leftist language, similar to that that's the language that students on the other side of the Iron Curtain were using, they get beaten up by a regime that claims to be leftist, claims to adhere to certain Marxist principles, and so on. And the regime loses credibility at that point. Then, a few months later, the Warsaw Pact invades Czechoslovakia, and this puts an end to hopes of, you know, any kind of reform within the system on, let's say, a socialist Marxist basis. What happens in the West is that students after 68 fails, part of them really radicalize towards the far left. In Poland, you see a different situation where students actually move away from ideology because they, through the revolt, what it teaches them, and especially also after 1970, right, when workers are being killed by a regime that claims to represent the interests of workers, they move away from ideology. But this, of course, discredits Marxist ideology. And there is less and less enthusiasm for this. At the same time, in the official organizations, a new generation comes to the fore. And these are people who are also caring less about ideology. And when Gede comes to power and opens Poland up to the West, it's ironically these people, like Kwasniewski and Cimoszewicz and Oleksii, because these are all names that might ring a bell, because these become quite prominent social democrat post-communist politicians after 89. These are people who also have a lot of contact with the West and so on. The ideology is disappearing within the official student organizations as well. Part of them that would adhere to the left, they would see themselves as some fledgling social democrats. Some later would even say that they're moving towards social liberalism because partly their context with the West. Now, among the opposition, you see a different evolution. So Marxism as a way of critiquing the regime, just like the Marxism of the regime, is discredited. Students become active also in other centers that were less traditionally known for their activism, like Gdańsk. And there you had specific conditions of the population as well. They came from the borderlands, pre-war Poland. They had experienced Soviet occupation in 1931. So there was not much sympathy for communism anyway. But on the other hand, I mean, the social glue of these regions was less. And only with the emergence of this younger generation in the 70s do you see that some kind of social glue has really come to the point that you could expect some kind of student organization. Now, the left being discredited, this opens up opportunity for other options, like the nationalists, like the Pilsudskiites. So a lot of the traditions of pre-war Poland start getting some interest. What is crucial here is that a certain book appears by Bohdan Cywiński that describes exactly the young lives of what would become later the elite of the Second Republic. And a lot of students get in touch and read this book, and it inspires them. So this gives a momentum to a sort of more right-wing nationalist ideology to emerge within the student milieu. And then a second factor in that is that the church actually becomes more active through its student parishes, through certain student parishioners who start working with students very successfully and spreading the Catholic worldview, which is also quite close to the nationalist worldview at the time. And this strengthens this kind of sort of right-wing ideology that is emerging among students. Of course, this even gets more strengthened by the end of the decade when a Pole gets elected to the papacy. And by the time Solidarność breaks out, so that generation of students is very much already in a different they actually shifted, in a sense, more to the right, which doesn't mean that there was no distinction left and right, but it changed meaning. Left didn't mean Marxist anymore. Left meant apolitical activity. Left meant activity within student self-government councils. But the right was winning the ideological battle. And as I mentioned before, that we have these sociological studies. So in the 80s, we noticed that the idea of socialism is no longer in socialism, in even the non-Soviet kind, sort of social democratic, whatever they imagined, wasn't popular anymore. So this opens up really the space in which this kind of right-wing, nationalist, patriotic, Catholic worldviews take hold within the student milieu. And of course, it's a period when there's less repression, so they're also much easier articulated, and they get then spread because students are by that time already printing their own underground journals and so on. So this, to a large extent, explains this kind of ideological shift. The seizure, the breaking point, is really 68, in which Marxism gets discredited. And then, of course, this evolution of this right ideology appearing. Now, it's also interesting to note that you see a similar situation emerging a few decades later, and exactly with the same protagonist that you might encounter in my book, because in a sense, as I said at the outset of our talk, I mean, student activists, they tend to become more important political players later in life. So a lot of these student activists from the 70s and the 80s, they go into politics later, and they really come to the fore in the late 90s, early 2000s. And this is one of the explanations one can put forward why right now in Poland you have a sort of pluralism on the right and a non-existent left, because those who were the post-communist left were exactly still the people who were actually the student activists in the official organizations in the 1970s.
The students that shocked me, my jaw dropped, and I know I'm not the only American who had the experience of having Polish students tell me how much they like Reagan. It was the norm. You expected it from old men who told me that, but it was when the young men told you that, my age, it was quite a shock. But this has been a wonderful tour of your book. I really enjoy it. I recommend it as a new way to look at how communism unfolded and unraveled in Poland. What are you working on now?
I'm working on several things. One big project that I'm working on now is looking into the inner party relations of the Polish Communist Party in the Cold War with fraternal communist parties and social democratic parties in Europe. And this is part of a bigger project, actually, on the history of the Polish Communist Party that is coordinated by the Institute of National Remembrance in Poland. Apart from that, I still work because, as I said, I'm kind of passionate about student politics. So I still work on student movements in the Cold Era, but rather than from comparative perspectives. So I've got some smaller projects running in that. And I also got more and more interested in contemporary student protest, and here more precisely in the recent protests in the Balkans and in Ukraine. And in the coming year, I hope to finish a book that I'm co-authoring on the student movement that emerged in Bulgaria in late 2013 during a very large wave of anti-government protests that took place there.
Well, that's very interesting, and I'm looking forward to seeing that when it comes out. You've been listening to New Books in East European Studies. I'm your host, Hugo Lane, and we've been speaking with Tom Junes about his book, Student Politics in Communist Poland, Generations of Consent and Dissent. Well, thank you very much, Tom, and you have a wonderful rest of your day.
Bye-bye. Well, thank you.